thanks everybody for coming. It's thank you for that great introduction, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be here. It's, you know, some things don't change, and that's very comforting to me. It's like nothing like coming home. I mean, 15 years ago, the Anthropology seminars were Wednesday afternoons in this room, and probably a different time, but it's really nice to have some constancy and fabulous to see everybody again. I'm going to talk about what Andrew said I'm going to talk about, and I want to just start with a tiny bit of natural history. It's sort of hard for me often to capture what I study in a single picture, and yet this, I think, does a pretty good job. It speaks coevolution to me, in part because the organism that's here, that's dead, is a highly specialized herbivore, a highly specialized caterpillar. That's a butterfly, the monarch butterfly. And it, the mom laid its egg on this leaf, and despite being highly specialized, this being essentially the only food source it has in the region where it was, the plant actively defended itself and killed this caterpillar. So it took its first few bites and was overwhelmed here by a droplet of latex and was killed, dragged to the leaf. And so despite a very long evolutionary history, adaptations on both parts of the organisms, the antagonistic relationship still goes on, and a large fraction of the caterpillars die like this. And what I want to do in today's seminar is talk about coevolution in particular, and to touch on, I guess what I consider four important topics in coevolution that have been addressed at varying levels throughout history, and I hope through one study system and a case study convince you that there's a strong case for that interaction going on. And those four topics are reciprocity. The way we define coevolution is a reciprocal interaction. I'll go through a more formal definition in a minute. Trade-offs, which I would argue are central to all adaptations, to thinking about and understanding all adaptations. Specialization, which I think is a hallmark of coevolutionary interactions. And I'll end with some new data we have on the genetics of adaptation, how some of those reciprocal interactions are mechanistically based, in this case, in the part of the organism. And the work I'm going to tell you about is a collaborative project, a set of projects. Sergio Rasmin is a former postdoc from my lab who contributed to a bunch of the work. And the last bit on the genetics of adaptation is a collaboration with Susanna Dobler, who's a professor at the University of Hamburg in Germany. So coevolution, just to kind of formalize things a little bit, the reciprocal genetic change in interacting species owing to natural selection imposed by each on the other. It's kind of a mouthful, but I think you get the idea. We're talking about evolution that occurs in both directions. We might visualize this with something like the following: in a predator-prey or a plant-herbivore interaction, although the coevolution can occur in other kinds of interactions, we expect that the defenses of a prey item are increasing in response to selection by some predator. That imposes selection on the predator or on the herbivore to increase its offensive or exploitative ability. And one form of coevolution that occurs is what we might think of as an arms race, whereby the phenotypes of the two organisms escalate or increase over time. That's not the only kind of thing. Trade-offs, as I've already mentioned, are central to most arguments, most adaptive arguments. The advantage of a trait or a genotype or a species in one context that's accompanied by a disadvantage in some other context. If there weren't trade-offs, we'd expect single traits or phenotypes or species to take over. Just to give you a sense of how important trade-offs are and the historical importance, Darwin wrote about trade-offs in The Origin of Species, and I just love this quote, so I'm going to read it to you. As Goethe expressed it, in order to spend on one side, nature is forced to economize on the other side. I think this holds true with our domestic productions. If nourishment flows to one part or organ in excess, it rarely flows in excess to the other part. So he's sort of there talking about a phenotypic trade-off in terms of resources moving from one place to another. Thus, it is difficult to get a cow to give much milk and to fatten readily. Darwin also recognized the importance of genetic trade-offs, and probably didn't think about it in those terms, but he continued to write, the same varieties of cabbage do not yield abundant and nutritious foliage and a copious supply of oil-bearing seeds. So thinking about varieties, genetic lineages, or of the same species that have been selected for to produce one thing, don't produce a lot of the other. Trade-offs are central to most adaptive arguments. I'll argue that the defenses of plants are no exception, and I'll try to unravel to you some of the trade-offs that are occurring in the expression of defenses in the plant that I've been studying. So given that plants are well defended, how do insects do it? And one of the clear answers is adaptation. and specialization. In this case, the plant is well defended, but some fraction of them survive, right? So if we think about the way this plant in particular, it's a milkweed, defends itself, one of the ways it produces a system of latex, it's pressurized, that exudes upon feeding. And the one of the behavioral mechanisms that the herbivores of milkweeds use is that they trench, they cut the latex delivery in the tissifers before they consume that leaf tissue. So this caterpillar is spending 20, 30 minutes deactivating those latex delivering canals. This is the first movie I ever made, so it's a little bit too long, but I was just so excited that I couldn't help myself. But basically, it's almost done now. It's cut the latex delivering veins. When it's done with that 25 minutes or whatever, it finally gets to eating, and as you can see, it's hungry, it's going to eat relatively rapidly. 10 minutes are going to go by, and then the movie will be done before then. Go by before, and they'll just consume that leaf. And if it had it not deactivated those latissifers, it'd be getting a mouthful of latex with every bite. So it sort of is now able to feed unencumbered.
So there's not much latex stored in the leaf itself? It's coming out of the main stem?
There's residual latex in the leaves, but it no longer exudes. That's right. Yeah, and people have done things, we talk about this more, like washed out the latex from the leaf to ask, what is the impact of that residual? I think that from my perspective, there's the toxins that the latex delivers, and there's the gummy part. This is more information than you need, but early botanists sort of liken latex to blood because it coagulates relatively quickly on exposure to air, and so that's a fair bit of the problem of consuming a latex-bearing plant for an herbivore is dealing with that massive stuff that's beginning to coagulate. So here's the outline of the talk, more natural history to come, genetically based plant defenses. So how are plants defending themselves? Do these have a heritable basis? Are there trade-offs in the defenses that the plants produce and how they're deployed? I'll talk about the evolution of specialization in one particular herbivore, this one, and the genetics of adaptation in this herbivore to feeding on the plants. So the group of plants I've been studying for the past decade or so has been the New World milkweeds in the genus Asclepias. This is just 9 species here. You can see kind of that common morphological form that through the last 5 million years has been stretched and recolored in various ways, but it's a sort of specialized floral form. There are about 130 species in North America. It was named by Linnaeus after the Greek god of medicine, in part because the plants have been used medicinally for thousands of years and they contain toxic secondary compounds that have been used in various ways for our own benefit. So that would be these compounds, the cardenolides. I'll talk more about them. But there are many other traits which may be important mediators of coevolutionary interactions than just chemistry. We've already talked about the latex. Here's a different feeder of milkweeds that again is clipping the veins in a different way and then feeding on tissues that are distal. There are trichomes, leaf hairs that are on the plants. This monarch caterpillar shaving a bed of leaves before it sinks its mandibles into the leaf. And there are various other things. There might be limiting nutrients or the morphological attributes of the plant that may serve as important mediators of evolution. These milkweeds are fed upon by a diversity of organisms. In this cartoon phylogeny, what we have is the fauna of one species, the common milkweed, Asclepias syriaca from the East Coast. You can see there's 3 beetles, a weevil, a leaf beetle, and a cerambycid. This is going to be the star of the rest of the talk today. There's a leaf mining fly in the same genus as the common greenhouse pest. It's a specialist on milkweeds. Several leps, a butterfly, and some moths, and several hemipterans, including 3 aphids and 2 Lygia bugs. So despite being a highly defended toxic plant, this one species has a diversity of herbivores that are actually divvying up the plant pretty amazingly in terms of the gills, and feeding on the seeds, the leaves, the sap, boring through the roots, etc. So the rest of the talk I'm going to focus on the red milkweed beetle, Tetrahochlis tetraophthalmus, as an interesting biology in that we see it mostly as an adult here. As an adult, it chews on leaves and chews on flowers a little bit, but is basically doing the bulk of its damage in feeding as a larva, that feeds on the roots. So here's a Tetraopis larva that has been born through roots. And its primary host, essentially its only natural host, is Asclepias rye, that's common to wheat. So to first show you that this herbivore, in fact, does impose some fitness cost to the plant through its feeding, when you introduce larvae at realistic numbers, they lay clutches of about 10 to 15 eggs at the base of milkweed plants grown in the field. And we look at the number of fruits from control plants that are free of root herbivory, or those that are experiencing root herbivory, we see that there's a substantial decline. And that's the case for looking at above ground biomass in the plants. Root herbivory causes declines, and in terms of the mass per fruit, so they're making smaller reproductive structures and seeds when they are experiencing root herbivory. So this herbivore is an important herbivore for this plant. Let's talk about traits that the plants might have to reduce the amount of herbivory, and we'll consider those both at the adult stage and then at the larval stage as well. So what we did was grew a common garden of this common milkweed. There are 500 odd plants from several 20 odd full sibling genetic families. They're grown intermixed in this common garden. And so it's a sort of straightforward design to ask about heritable variation in traits. By having a whole bunch of genotypes intermixed in one common garden, we expect that variation among families is due to a genetic basis because they are intermixed throughout that common garden. If we look at resistance traits that are heritable, these are heritabilities. They're all relatively low, as Michael Torelli told me when I took the Pop Bio Core class. All heritabilities are between 0.2 and 0.8. That's sort of, most of these are between 0.2 and 0.8. If you look at the amount of latex that is exuding, the toughness of the leaves, the trichomes, the cardenolides, the nitrogen content, they're all heritable. They're all highly variable among the plant genotypes from when they're grown in this common garden. I'll show you some of that data here. So the y-axis of these graphs are the adult Tetraopis, the abundance of them, using a point count, walking out into the field, how many insects are on these plants. The x-axis are two traits, the amount of latex and the amount of trichomes. Each dot summarizes about 20 individual plants from one genetic family that are mixed up throughout this common garden. So the first thing I want you to notice is that there's a lot of genetically based variation in these traits. The amount of latex exuded upon damage, about fourfold variation depending on these families. The amount of trichomes, it's I think like twofold variation among the families. And for both of these traits, they're not particularly beautiful scatters, but the higher the trait value for latex and for trichomes, the fewer adult Tetraopis we found per plant. I'm not going to show you all of the traits that didn't co-vary with resistance, but cardenolides did not, nor did the other traits that I showed you before. The other last thing I want to mention is these two traits themselves are not correlated. So latex and trichomes are not correlated here, so those are independent in terms of their impacts. How about the larvae? So again, the larvae bore through the roots. It's a little bit more challenging to think about the traits that might be important. And in fact, those last two traits, the trichomes and the latex, are sort of out of the picture. The laticifers, the anatomy is there in the roots of Asclepias, but they do not exude latex. So some of you maybe have like cut dandelions or other plants that make latex, like in the Asteraceae, they often will exude latex from the roots. They don't in Asclepias. Trichomes aren't really a feature here. Here we focused on the cardenolides for better or for worse because it was a trait that we could measure easily. And what we did is we screened many genotypes for variation in root cardenolides, and we picked three high cardenolide genotypes and three low cardenolide genotypes root from the roots to study further. And what we did was we put them in the field. We basically grew these rings of six plants. I think this is about a meter distance between. The herbivores are not drawn to scale here. They are Tetraopis larvae, but they're not that big. And so we had 20 such rings, and six of the three plants are three, one individual each of those three low cardenolide genotypes, and the other three are three individuals, one each of the three high cardenolide genotypes. So here we're going to show you larval recovery on the high cardenolide genotypes versus the low. Basically, are digging up the soil and putting them in a modified funnel, and basically are pulling out the larvae that we can. Here, high cardenolides results in lower recovery of those larvae from the field, so we have some indication from this screen that genetically based variation in root cardenolides are impacting the larval, let's say, growth or survival recovery. Okay, so far, I hope I've convinced you that the plants have a set of traits that can affect these herbivores at both life stages, both at the adult stage and the larval stage. They're heritable. And those defenses are deployed in various ways. And I want to discuss with you now how those are deployed and trade-offs, potential trade-offs in the deployment of those kinds of traits. The first thing I want to tell you about is not something that's new to this department. Induction of defenses has been studied for several decades. The roots of common milkweed are no different. So if we look at the cardenolide content in control roots, or roots damaged by Tetraopis larvae, it's a relatively small effect here, but there's, a 15% increase in the cardenolides after damage. And this will be important later on, but we can define that increase in the amount of cardenolides as the inducibility. How much do they upregulate those compounds after damage? I'm going to take a little bit of a digression here and tell you about another kind of defense and then get to the trade-offs in a moment. So one thing that's been well studied above ground is the volatile signaling mechanisms that plants often use that attract in predators and parasitoids of herbivores. The same thing has been recently described from roots of a few different systems whereby, this is not a milkweed here, I don't know what it is, maybe a bean plant or something. Upon damage by a root feeding herbivore, there are volatiles which are emitted, and entomopathogenic nematodes are one common group of organisms that are attracted to those root volatiles that are emitted. And with my postdoc Sergio, we decided to look for such induced volatiles and attraction of entomopathogenic nematodes to damaged roots as a way to study two different defensive mechanisms in the root, and then to go on to study the trade-offs that might occur in terms of deploying the cardenolides versus these volatiles. So in the lab, we can grow up the plants and suck the air through the rhizosphere on control plants or herbivore damaged plants. What I'm showing you here is a whole bunch of volatile organic compounds. Each pair is a single volatile organic compound that's identified using GCMS. There's a whole bunch of them in these milkweed roots. What I want you to notice is that their amounts are consistently higher in the red bars over the blue. So upon feeding by Tetraopis larvae in the rhizosphere of Asclepias, those roots are then giving off VOCs higher amounts than would be in the controls. There's a whole bunch of them. Maybe the most important thing to notice, if we look at the total VOCs given off by the roots in the damaged state, it is substantially higher. I can't remember, it's several fold higher than the controls. Okay, but does that result in actually attraction of entomopathogenic nematodes? We again conducted kind of a mesocosm experiment, and this was replicated in the field. I'm not going to show you those data, where we grow milkweed plants that are undamaged or have the tetraopis in the roots. And in this case, we're going to take a waxworm, a sentinel larva that's not feeding on the rhizosphere of those milkweed roots, and simply tuck it in to the rhizosphere there or here, and then introduce entomopathogenic nematodes in the middle and ask them to move. In our lab experiment, it might have been only moving, say, 10 to 20 centimeters, in the field about a meter, and ask, do they preferentially infect the sentinel waxworms that are in the damaged rhizosphere? And we find that repeatedly, the effect is larger or smaller depending on the case, but here we see greater infection by entomopathogenic nematodes. They're orienting towards where those damaged roots are, the volatiles are. Okay. So the first hypothesis about trade-offs that's been out there in the literature for quite a while is based largely on redundancy arguments or arguments about if you have one effective defense, you shouldn't need another. I'd be the first to admit that there's sort of problems with that verbal argument in the sense that no defense is perfect, and so we shouldn't necessarily expect that high amounts of volatile indirect defenses should result in low amounts of direct defenses. But that is the prediction nonetheless, and we set out to test it using a set of different genotypes of Asclepias syriaca that varied in these traits. So So again, the prediction, sorry, is that there's a trade-off between the amount of fertilized or volatile organic compounds. Here we see no correlation between the VOCs and the cardenolides across 11 genotypes. 11 is not a huge sample size, but each one of these, again, has several replicates in a common environment. If anything, you'd think the pattern was positive. It's certainly not negative in terms of volatiles and cardenolides. The second prediction that I want to talk about, and this is a prediction that I've tried to trace the origin of this prediction, and it comes back to a paper by Allison Brody and Rick Carbon, 1992, I believe, but they just kind of said that this was a prediction, but it's sort of based on the same kind of logic, but I actually don't think that Rick gets enough credit for coming up with this prediction because it sort of wasn't a formal hypothesis that they put forward. Nonetheless, the prediction is that constitutive investment in a defense should trade off with the amount that it induces. And the idea, again, is based a bit on redundancy. Four genotypes that have a high level of investment in constitutive cardenolides or VOCs, we expect that the amount that they increase, that is the difference between the damage and the undamaged state, will be relatively low. Those genotypes are putting a lot up front. They get damaged. If they get damaged, perhaps that trait is not effective at all and it doesn't increase. Those genotypes that invest relatively little upfront constitutively, we expect that after damage there'll be a high level of increase following the damage. We use those same 11 genotypes. So on the x-axis here is the constitutive cardenolides. So there's 11 genotypes. On the y-axis is their inducibility. How much do they increase following damage? This is a significant negative relationship. We have found a similar negative relationship when we use larger data sets, 20 genotypes. A relatively consistent finding, we've done this two or three times, is that the highest constitutive genotypes actually decline in their cardenolide levels after damage. And that's something I don't understand, but I truly believe it in that we've done this, like I say, a few different times with different sets of plants. Those that put the most up front after damage, after they actually decline. And perhaps this is really an ineffective strategy. I'm being eaten. I'm not going to do that. I don't know, but it seems to be a repeatable pattern. That negative correlation holds for the deployment of root volatiles as well. And this was a surprise to us. I wasn't really expecting this, but the genotypes that produce a lot of VOCs constitutively in the absence of damage are the lowest inducers. Again, in fact, here they're actually declining in the VOCs that are in the rhizosphere, whereas those that put the least upfront constitutively induce the most. So to conclude from part one of the talk, what I hope I've shown you so far is that Tetramilkweeds, these four-eyed beetles, specialists on milkweeds, they reduce asclepias fitness at realistic densities. The milkweeds are rich with heritable defensive traits that reduce herbivory both above and below ground. This herbivore's life cycle dictates that it deals with both. It appears to be the chemical compounds underground and the latex and the trichomes above ground. And lastly, that genotypes show a trade-off in the deployment of cardenolides and root volatiles, but not between these two different strategies. So if the cardenolides are the direct defense in terms of poisoning the herbivore, and the volatile organic compounds are indirect defense in terms of attracting in the natural enemies, those two strategies themselves do not trade off across genotypes. But the deployment of each of those does show that negative relationship. One thing that we're sort of interested in, we haven't gotten around to, is there could be a common mechanism by which those trade-offs occur among the VOCs and the cardenolides. It could be something that's, say, jasmate-dependent. And if that's the case, then we might expect that those high constitutive genotypes have a low burst of the hormones that regulate both those direct and indirect defenses. So there could be a common mechanism there. Okay, so on to specialization. So the herbivore is highly specialized. In this case, it's monophagous. In the field, it essentially only eats, has only been found, the larvae have only been found in the roots of common milkweed. The adults will chew on the leaves of some other asclepias, but they're really not getting much out of them. And it's a long-standing question in evolutionary ecology as to what drives the evolution of specialization. The notion that's very common, of course, is that jack of all trades is master of none. And that is by specializing, the organism has the ability to maximally exploit a resource. And in this case, the resources, particularly as we've shown, pretty well defended, may not be an easy one to consume, and therefore specialization will presumably have its benefits. What I want to do is talk to you about an experiment that Sergio and I conducted over the last couple of years, where we took a kind of a different approach to studying the evolution of specialization than has been used historically in the past. And it's a phylogenetic approach where we use the relatedness among different milkweed species to test whether a highly specialized herbivore has reduced performance as the phylogenetic distance and presumably the phenotypic dissimilarity increases away from that host. And I'm going to repeat that again and try to walk you through it in a minute. This is a molecular phylogeny of a Asclepias, totally pruned down to the 17 species that we used in the study. Again, if you remember, there are those 130 Asclepias. This is just sort of interesting natural history information. There are 23 species of Tetraopes beetles, and they are apparently singly associated with a single species of Asclepias. So how true exactly that is sort of not entirely clear, but you can see here's five of these Tetraopes beetles, and they're largely associated with single Asclepias species. We want to focus in this case on the Tetraopes tetraophthalmus, where its primary host is Asclepias syriaca, shown here. And the hypothesis I want to test is that if we look at its performance, if we introduce larvae to a closely related species, in this case Asclepias obovata, where the phylogenetic distance is relatively short, we expect to see the performance of that beetle to be close to or not terrible compared to Asclepias syriaca, because we're using the notion that phylogenetic distance is proportional to some phenotypic dissimilarity. Alternatively, if we introduce those larvae to Asclepias nivea, where on the x-axis, if we see genetic distance is on the x-axis, there's a much larger distance, we expect that performance would be lower. And the reason we took this approach to try to study the evolution of specialization is that the lion's share of the work on host range evolution and specialization is done with generalists. It's not true for all cases, but the bulk of the work is done on generalists. And what people do is they take generalists and they try to specialize them to particular plant species or plant genotypes and ask if there are trade-offs. And I think that's a fabulous approach, but there seemed to me that those generalists, the biology of those generalists is probably pretty different in that as species they have maintained a generalist strategy. And they may not be the best species, or you certainly wouldn't want all of your tests about the evolution of specialization to be with generalists. And so by taking a specialist, the problem with taking a specialist, of course, is that it's specialized and you can't get it to eat all these crazy different things. So we expected in this case that we would be able to get survival and growth on closely related milkweeds to ask the question of whether that would be decreasing with increasing phylogenetic distance. So what I'm going to show you is a couple of graphs. We have on the x-axis here phylogenetic distance from the true host, Asclepias syriaca, an index of larval survival of Tetraopes on the y-axis. And in this case, phylogenetic distance is a significant predictor of Tetraopes survival. You know, what I would take away from this, what I do, is that the true host does very well. There's sort of this cloud of intermediate phylogenetic distances. And these five species that are further out phylogenetically, there's basically no survival on. This effect is largely predicted, not completely, by the root cardenolides in those 17 milkweed hosts. So again, each one of these dots is a species of milkweed. Here you're seeing the constitutive cardenolides and the roots on the x-axis of the larval survival, and there's also a negative relationship here. Interestingly, plug your ears if you're not interested in this kind of thing, but this relationship is not significant in the raw form. This is sort of the raw data, and it's only significant in the phylogenetically independent contrast. And the reason is kind of an interesting one. These four species that have very low cardenolides, but also relatively low survival, are often one clade in that phylogeny. And so they actually are contributing disproportionately. They're not contributing four data points to the actual regression in when it's phylogenetically corrected. That's just sort of interesting because we normally think of it going the other way by accounting for phylogeny, we're sort of making our relationships more conservative. And we are doing that, but in this case, the four closely related species that fall kind of away from the line are sort of helping our significance. Sorry if that's weird to you. Okay.
Oh, here we are.
So we're at the last part of the talk where we're going to move from thinking about specialization in terms of how the performance of those beetles. I guess what I want to conclude from this work is that the performance of these beetles does seem to be constrained by the phenotypes, in this case the cardenolides of the roots on the plants that they're eating, and that the specialization to that host, sort of the performance decays as we move phylogenetically away, which I think is consistent with our notion of how specialization occurs to particular phenotypes. On to the genetics of that equation, and I'll be done in like 10 minutes. Why are cardenolides toxic? So these are incredible compounds, and I wasn't really a chemical ecologist when I left Davis, but I feel like I've become increasingly one. And just as sort of a side note, I've been recently reading the papers of this guy Sieber and then Sean Duffy, who were both here. And amazing work on cardenolides that those guys did in the 70s, independently did. The reason cardenolides are toxic is they bind to the sodium-potassium pump. And the sodium-potassium pump is this ubiquitous enzyme that all animal cells use to move ions across the border. So moving ions across the border is super important for cells, for animal cells. They do all kinds of things. They're involved in neurological function, cardiac function, hence the name cardiac glycoside, excretion, etc. Cardenolides bind to the sodium-potassium pumps, and they basically stop them from functioning. And that's one reason why they've been used medicinally. That can be useful to slow down or alter the heart rates of organisms. It's also why they are incredibly toxic, and very generally toxic, because all animals have these pumps. Cardenolides bind to the pump and stop them from functioning. Through work in biochemistry, often of in mammalian cells, it's known that the first extracellular loop of the sodium-potassium pump, the ATPase, and the alpha subunit region has been implicated in how physically cardenolides bind to that pump and stop it from functioning. And so with my collaborator, Susanna Dobler, what we wanted to do is address how tetraopes and the other herbivores of milkweed do it. How do they reduce that binding in a way that results in maybe not immunity? We know that the cardenolides negatively impact tetraopes. I've shown you those data. But how it is that they're able to tolerate some level of those toxins. So what we did is we are looking into the genetic sequences and the amino acids in the extracellular loop of the sodium-potassium pump. And there is very, very, very deep conservation of the amino acids in this region of the gene across the animal kingdom. So here's pig, Drosophila, cat flea, Manduca, and Tribolium. Very deep conservation. We can ask if there are genetic substitutions in the sodium-potassium pump for the tetraopes beetle. And so here's tetraopes on the last line, and we see at position 111, and I know this doesn't mean very much to you, doesn't mean very much to me either, but at this one position, there is a leucine where there should have been a glycine, where across much of the rest of the animal kingdom, there was a glycine. So the amazing thing that you can do, or that one can do, is we can ask functionally whether there's a single base pair change, which causes a single amino acid change, actually results in some reduced cardenolide sensitivity. So Susanna Dobler's lab, in collaboration with her, we conducted a bioassay with cardenolides, asking whether the genetic substitution in the sodium-potassium pump was actually functional. So in this graph, we have Drosophila cells, with the wild type being here in orange, the glycine at 111, single base pair substitution, which adds that leucine amino acid at position 111 here. Time is on the x-axis, and the number of surviving cells under a dosage of wabane, a standard cardenolide, in the cell culture. And what you see is that substitution provides some level of resistance. It's functional in terms of reducing the cardenolide binding to the sodium-potassium pump, and thereby not providing immunity. And I think that's a really important point. We often think of these specialist herbivores that have all of these adaptations being immune to those. Cardenolides slow these guys down for sure. They probably kill them. but they are able to tolerate them at some level. So the summary of part two is that these Tetraopis beetles, their performance shows a phylogenetic signal from its true host. They do the best on the true host. And specialization is driven in part by being able to tolerate those recordenolides. Genetic substitutions in the sodium-potassium pump provide some resistance to this for the life, but it's not complete. And I think, in part, the way it works is simply by reducing the binding affinity, the amount of cardenolites that are floating around, a smaller fraction of their binding pump, and are able to stop it from functioning. So in the last couple minutes, I just want to do a little bit of a thought experiment for you. I've focused in this entire seminar, except for at the very beginning, on these Tetraopis beetles, which clearly have a strong impact and a neat relationship with these plants. But how do we might think coevolution proceeds at some community level? So I showed you that there are those 12 herbivores that feed on common milkweed. Are they all involved in some kind of coevolutionary interaction? Or might there be, the analogy I want to make is that between drivers and passengers. There might be some organisms which are driving the adaptations and others which have to adapt but are maybe not reciprocally involved in that coevolutionary interaction. So here are those 12 herbivores from all the different feeding guilds on common milkweed. And the thing I can tell you from kind of current experiments in current time, we don't know anything about the history, is that two of these herbivores are really the ones that can impose selection or reduce the performance of common milkweed. And it's this weevil, which I haven't talked about, and the Serinus, which I haven't. I love monarch butterflies as much as the next guy, but they lay one egg per plant. Adult butterflies avoid plants with eggs. The lion's share of those eggs die early on. Those that actually make it don't impose more than a few percent leaf herbivory. At least in the current scheme of things, the way it's going on in the field right now, they are not an important selective agent, as are none of these other herbivores are, except for these two either. If we look for the genetic substitutions in the sodium-potassium pump among these 12 species, and I'm not going to show you the data, we basically find functional substitutions at most of these organisms. We haven't been able to get the primers to work for the aphids. And Eucanes egglii, this Arctean moth, is decidedly no. Its sodium-potassium pump appears to be the wild type. It's doing something totally different. But I guess what I'd argue is at least the scene from sort of 2012 is that these two herbivores are important drivers in terms of imposing selection on the plant, whether they were historically, I can't tell you. But the rest of these herbivores may be passengers. If they want to eat this plant, they need to have those substitutions as well as other traits that they can utilize those plants, but they may not be, or at least they aren't currently imposing strong selection on the plant. And I think that's just an important thing to think about as we think about coevolution, because it's not a pairwise thing, but it's also not necessarily a community-wide interaction either. I'm going to stop there. These are the same conclusions. Thanks for your attention. Happy to answer questions.
So in your phylogeny part there, so I'm curious, you sort of started with that assumption that there's some relationship between phenotypic and phylogenetic distance, and there's clearly some signal there for the cardenolides, but you measured other traits on these, presumably, and what do those all say? I mean, is it consistent across lots of them? Does it matter which trait you use?
It matters which traits you use. So there are some traits for which we see little or no phylogenetic signal, and others that we do. I don't feel like I understand that in particular yet. It's true, this is kind of an interesting piece. When we've surveyed a whole bunch more species, like 35 or 50 species, the defensive traits, or what I put in the category of defensive traits, show a consistently different evolutionary history in terms of how they evolve, not necessarily only their phylogenetic signal, than like neutral traits, or what I think, like we do leaf shape, or the specific leaf area, growth rate of the plants, that they show a different sort of pattern or signature in the phylogenetic history than do the defensive traits. So that's the one thing I can say about pattern differences, but yeah. Neil.
I guess it's a follow-up question, so that's good. Again, with the phylogenetic analysis, it seems like there's a possibility to test different models for how we think specialization evolves there, which at least you're not using in this current thing. So I was thinking about directionality. So we can think about specialization and coevolution of sort of adding something on, and this species is sort of at the tip.
Yeah.
And so one thing, thinking back, you might expect them to be able to cope better with things that are basal or things that are tip, rather than just distance. Did you look at that? Would that give you even more resolution? Do you have any sense of that?
That's an interesting question. We haven't done it with these guys. I mean, I haven't studied the other Tetraopis beetle. In this case, it appears that specialization in the genus Tetraopis is ancestral, or that those 23 species, I think, are all pretty specialized. So I don't think in this genus there's like that kind of directional trend. I will say that I only showed you a portion of that data, and Tetraopis beetle, the Tetraophthalmus, does better on plant species that have other Tetraopis beetles associated with them, and there's some habitat affiliation. So there is other variation to explain there. The last thing I'll say, and I think that this like idea is now dead, that specialization is a dead end. So like that was sort of a common idea that the specialization should only occur at the tips. And there are like emerging meta-analyses and things like that that I guess generalists arise as often from specialized lineages as do specialists. That's sort of,
The previous slide where you showed the aphids and not kind of cardinalites. One thing I think of milkweeds, if it's not from modern butterflies, they're always swarming with aphids. Are they specialists or generalists or what's?
They're all specialists. The yellow ones that are really common, Aphis nerii, they'll eat anything in the Apocynaceae, pretty much in the whole family.
How do you think they're getting around the problem?
Well, we just don't know if they have substitutions yet, sorry.
Okay.
So, and we just couldn't get the molecular work to the sequencing to work yet. So I actually think that it's pretty, I think that Aphis nerii, Susanna Dobler now believes, does have a substitution at 111 and 122, but sort of there's something about doing the sequencing that's made it harder. Yeah. But they are specialists.
How does Tetraopi store its cardiac glycosides? Because, of course, in monarchs and in Archelaus at least,
yes,
they're stored in the cuticle biophysically.
Yes.
And do you have any connection between that gene substitution that you find, I'll call it gene substitution, anyways, and the method of storage? Is that what's going on?
I don't know. It's the cardenolides in the Tetraopis are at least as concentrated in the elytra as they're in the elytra. We've been looking at that in part because we want to use to figure out really their larval hosts. I think the way to do it is to maybe look at the root cardenolite profiles and what's in their elytra, which are obviously formed only when they're underground, not using what's in their body. I don't know the rest of the answers other than to say they do sequester, and one pattern that seems to be emerging there, Susanna has other herbivores that are not Asclepias syriaca feeders that she sequenced, and on average, the sequesterers have more substitutions than the non-sequester. So the Arctia there, Eucades eglii, basically is not a sequester. It doesn't have a substitution. Labodomera, the leaf beetle, also has a substitution and is not a sequester, so the pattern is not perfect, but it appears that the genetic substitutions are more common among sequestering insects. And that in some way makes sense if they're sort of having to take it in and deal with it in their bodies, and that they might fit, yeah.
I'm really intrigued by the result that the plants that have the largest levels of constitutive resistance then lose some of that and make it damage.
Yes.
And you told us that there's not a trade-off between those, you know, the two kinds of defenses.
Yes.
If you just look at the plants that start off with, you know, this giant arsenal of constitutive defenses, when they lose those, do just those plants, do they take on the other defense?
So a high cardenolide constitutive plant gets damaged, it lowers the cardenolides. Are they producing more volatiles?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that. It seems like that could be not the case if that's captured in that first graph I showed with volatiles against cardenolides, but I don't remember if the y-axis is constitutive cardenolides or constitutive volatiles.
And even then, it could be that the overall, you know, mm-hmm. relationship,
yeah.
there's nothing there, but if you just
yeah.
look at that one portion.
Yeah, it's worthwhile to do. I mean, I think we want to, I believe the result, as I mentioned a few times, so I think that it's worth pursuing to try to understand what's going on there. Especially, like, also with the VOCs, it sort of makes me think, like, okay, the roots get fed upon, you'd think there'd just be more VOCs there just due to leakage of damaged tissues, and the fact that it goes down in the highest constitutive ones tells you that there's something a little bit more going on there, I think. Yeah.
So with the idea that some herb pores have a really big selective pressure on the plants and others are really small, is that sort of a predictable thing across taxa? Is it just because root feeders and seed feeders are important? And if so, would the conclusion be that really most of the defenses we see in plants are because of particular gills?
I like the way you think, but I'd love it if that was the case. In this case, it's the root feeder and it's a stem feeding weevil was the other one.
Okay, it was like a stem feeding weevil.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know, I feel like there should be LEPs that have a big impact on their host plants, right? But it seems like it's not the case here, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in that, guys, yeah. Phil.
Hi, Mark. You said a good part of the phylogenetic correlation was, or trade-off, the distance relationship was explained by the level of cardenolides.
Yes.
And yet you also said these plants have different species all the time, like tetraopis, so I was trying to understand that. Is it some of the ones that are high levels are simply tetropes free, and are there some subsets of things that escape tetropes?
Yeah, so sorry, I think there's only 23 of the 130 Asclepias are hosts of tetropes. And of the 17, I didn't sort of explain this well, we chose 8 that had tetropes naturally and 8 that didn't, so that we could have that as a separate kind of contrast. Yeah. So I think that there's some of that that basically comes out of the scatter in the sense that there are some distant phylogenetically distant species which also have low cardenolides, but presumably they're doing something else. Yes. Yeah.
In one of your key experiments to look at the impact of the cardenolides on the tetraopes, you put out magic rings of 6 plants.
Yes.
3 from the high line, or high, I guess it was a line,
yep.
3 from a low line. And then you found fewer larvae
yes.
associated with the roots when you dug up the high line plants versus the low line plants.
Yes.
And what I didn't catch was whether or not you were adding larvae.
Sorry, yes. We added, I think, 10 or 5 larvae basically to the base of the plant. And so mm-hmm. they as soon as they have, they burrow straight down. We don't know how far they mm-hmm. move. They are... whatever that is, 30 centimeters from the closest next plant. The
mm-hmm.
ring is a meter or so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was obviously a really good way to do it. On the other hand, the numbers retrieved seem so low. Yes, there was a difference that there might be some important interaction between whatever factor was driving the numbers down so low to begin
yeah.
with and the actual impacts of the two types.
Yeah. If I was to do the experiment over, we would have added 3 times as many. I mean, I think you're absolutely right in the sense that we just didn't know how many would survive. We expected much higher survival, although recovery is one of those things. I mean, I'm blown away that we got any out. We sort of took shovels
yeah.
and sort of, yeah. I agree that the survival is low. The difference is statistically significant in sort of the beds.
All right, so it's 1 o'clock. I know there's some a little bit past. I know there's some students who have classes to get to. There's no class after this, so if people want to stick around and continue to ask questions, by all means. But let's give Dr. Agrawal a big hand.